Oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. Court has only two matters on its oral submission docket this morning. They are, in the interest of VLK from Tarrant County, and Levine versus Bain, Snell, and Krause from Bexar County. In each of these arguments, the court has allotted 20 minutes for oral argument and the for each side, and the petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We are recording these arguments, and you may purchase a tape for a nominal fee from our clerk. We're now ready to hear argument from petitioners in the interest of VLK.
May it please the court, Mr. John Clark will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is John Clark. I'm here today with Mr. Toby Goodman. Together we represent the petitioners, James and Medina Hicks, in the petition for review. I think it's relevant to provide the court a very basic factual statement of the central issue that I think affects the issues raised on the petition for review. This case began when Ms. Kilgore shot and killed her husband, the father of the child. During the pendency of the time that she was awaiting trial in the criminal case, the child was placed in the possession of third parties and eventually placed in possession of James and Medina Hicks. Medina Hicks is the paternal aunt of the child. After placing the child with the Hicks, Ms. Kilgore was fearful of them pursuing legal action, and she entered into an agreed order, an agreed decree, in suit affecting the parent-child relationship, naming her mother, Jean Christensen, the sole managing conservator of the child. That order was obtained without notice to the Hicks. When the Hicks became aware of the decree, they filed a motion to modify, requesting removal of Ms. Christensen as sole managing conservator and naming them as sole managing conservator. Ms. Kilgore thereafter filed a motion to modify requesting similar relief. The central issue brought forward on the petition for review is the impact of the parental presumption contained within Section 153.131 in a modification of conservatorship case. Specifically, does the presumption continue to control or apply in a circumstance where a third party has sole managing conservatorship of a child and modification of that custodial order is requested?
Why shouldn't it apply as a matter of policy?
Your Honor, the presumption was intended to address original proceedings. In this case, we had an order that was implemented, was put in place.
But as a policy matter, why should it be different whether the proceeding is original or a subsequent modification proceeding?
The purpose of the policy is to ensure that parents' rights are initially protected and preserved. Once an order has been put in place that affects the relationship of a child, the need for the protection established by that presumption has already been addressed in that initial order. In this case, Leanne Kilgore had the opportunity to ensure that protection until the point in time that she gave custody to a third party. The presumption that applied was already rebutted or overcome at that point in time when Ms. Kilgore obtained the agreed decree. The issue in the modification is not necessarily Ms. Kilgore's rights to the child, it's the child's custodial relationship. The statutes very clearly state we have one burden for modification cases and one burden for presumptions. You'll note that 153 is contained in the provisions that address original proceedings. The modification statute is contained under 156, 101.
I understand. I was just trying to understand the policy as to why you would give deference in one and not in the other. Or presumption. Just the basic policy considerations as to why that would be.
The policy that has been addressed by the decisions that I have reviewed indicates that we are looking for the least amount of intrusion into a parent-child relationship. Courts have framed lesser intrusive relationships, for example, by naming a joint conservatorship between a parent and a non-parent, considering that that presumption would not control in that circumstance. There are many modification cases that discuss that issue and simply state that the presumption does not control in that circumstance.
So what about Taylor versus Meeks? That it's a factor. Do you disagree with what Taylor said?
Taylor versus Meeks, as I read, Your Honor, indicated that where the the original proceedings, the parents were divorced, and the maternal grandparent was awarded custody in that original proceeding. There already was an interference in it in an original proceeding, and the modification was always going back to that original action. We had the same parties before the court. The Court of Appeals reversed it.
Well, I mean, what about the legal theory aside from the factual distinctions?
I think the legal theory, Your Honor, is that the...
It does say that the presumption is not controlling, but it is a factor to be considered.
I agree. It is a factor, Your Honor. In this case, the instruction given to the jury, which is the central issue, did not say there is no parental issue to consider. It was my concern in trial was that people, jurors, and judges always have a natural preference toward a parent and keeping the child in that circle.
Well, that's exactly the reason for the presumption, isn't it?
That is correct, Your Honor. But in this case, the presumption should not continue to apply because...
Well, there's a difference between not applying and not controlling. Would you agree to that? When Taylor versus Meek says it's a factor to be considered.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree.
So it doesn't disappear in its entirety, does it?
I don't think in its entirety legally, no. I don't think it disappears in its entirety.
Again, the question seems to me, the instruction given by the court doesn't acknowledge it as a factor, but goes exactly the other way and says no presumption of any kind is to be considered here.
The argument to the jury, Your Honor, was that there is a natural...
Well, I understand that, but the court didn't instruct them in the law to that extent.
No, Your Honor, the court...
instructed them the other way.
The court indicated that there should be no preference. That is correct, Your Honor, because of the circumstances of this case and that it was a modification case. The parent had already relinquished the position to a third party, and it was seeking to modify...
No, but we do agree that under the modification, both sides have the same burden. In fact, in this case.
I agree that that is true, Your Honor. But in modification,
so Kilgore, the only thing that's different is how do you treat the parental presumption?
The question is whether or not that is the overriding burden in this case, and I would submit that it is not the overriding burden. It is not the presumptive controlling
no,
burden.
No, but would you agree that it's a factor?
I think the parental preference is a factor in any case, Judge, because of...
Right. So you agree with that. Then should it be in an instruction to the jury in this kind of case?
I think it is appropriate for the judge to instruct the jury of the impact of the court orders as it relates to those rights that are established and protected by law. I do think that is appropriate. I believe.
Are you aware of any other cases where your argument is that there is no presumption?
Okay? That's correct.
And because there is no presumption, the jury should be instructed that there is no presumption. Are you aware of any other cases in Texas under any other theory of law where when there is no presumption, the jury is instructed that there is no presumption?
I am not aware of any cases that indicate to that nature. I'm aware of cases that indicate that if a presumption is rebutted, there's no instruction given, for example, in the affirmative that I am entitled to that presumption. And I would submit, again, under the nature of this case, because of the existing order, and my belief that jurors have a natural preference toward a parent, that the instruction was appropriate given the actions of Ms. Kilgore. If the court understands, my clients would agree that if there were no order, I believe the presumption would be controlling this case.
Right.
But we are treating to my clients as if no order existed. This order, the decree that gave custody to a third party, was given for the purposes of interfering or attempting to limit the Hicks' opportunity to litigate the issue about custody.
Does it make any difference that the Hicks were not parties to the proceeding that gave rise to the original order?
I do not believe it does, Your Honor.
Why not? Sir,
because equity in this situation would indicate they were in possession of the child. Under the family code, this code provides that a person who may have an interest should have been given notice.
But vis-a-vis the mother and the Hicks, they have never litigated the question of who should have custody as to those two parties. So why isn't this more in the nature of an original proceeding as to those parties?
Because both parties are not seeking action as to each other. They're seeking action as to the sole managing conservatory of a third party. They are both seeking to address the custodial relationship as to the third party. Whatever circumstances existed, if in fact there is some cross burden or burden between the Hickses and the Kilgore. That would apply in any conservatorship status. If you had a PC that's not a parent, is there some additional burden between those parties? I submit that the family code burden simply says, as to the managing conservator, has there been a material change of circumstances, and would it be a positive improvement? And so I do not think that the fact that she's a parent and a possessory conservator creates an additional burden as between movements seeking to remove a sole managing conservator.
Mr. Clark, getting back to Mrs. Baker's question, you can see that parental preference is a factor. Is that right?
I believe emotionally parental preference is a factor. Yes, Your Honor, okay. I absolutely believe that.
Here in the jury instruction, there is no reference to parental preference being a factor. So do you think that the instructions were wrong?
I believe the instruction was correct because of the nature of the argument that was made both at voir dire and during the closing, that I recognize the natural affinity that these jurors would have. They were voir dire on the issue of how they perceive those
relationships. But the instruction doesn't talk about parental preference being a factor, does it?
It indicates that there is not one in the circumstance of this case if there's been a
factor. It talks about presumption, doesn't it?
Pardon, Your Honor?
Does the instruction deal with presumption as opposed to a
Yes,
factor?
Your Honor. Presumption in favor of naming a parent the sole managing conservator of a child based upon that preference.
Are you saying this instruction was appropriate in this case because of the nature of the voir dire?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying the instruction was appropriate in this case because of the nature of the case as it existed, in that there was an order, there was some question about the way that decree was obtained. That was a fundamental point.
Was that evidence presented to the jury? Was the original order presented to the jury? Was that argued to the jury?
Yes, Your Honor. And the impact of that order was also argued in terms of evidentiary issues to the trial court, because in a normal modification case, that order creates a point in time from which evidence is produced as to the moving party. In this case, the Hicks possession began before that order, and the question was, where in time do we submit the evidence given the nature of this action? And equitably, Judge, my concern always has been, if there is no order, I completely agree with the arguments we're here. But we avoid that order in this case, it appears. The Court of Appeals says that order has no impact. And that seems not to assist the courts in establishing a very clear line about how parents and third-party litigants should address these issues, how we should modify these cases. The code says we start with original proceedings here. Once we have those original proceedings, whatever the circumstances and the nature of the relationship that is created there is modified under these terms. The modification statute speaks not only in terms of parents, it speaks in terms of other persons. So it's clear that it was intended to develop a method to change the custodial order once it is implemented.
Mr. Clark, if the jury should not have been instructed in the way that it was, if it was error from the trial court to do so, was that error harmful?
I have no evidence that it was, Your Honor, and that was one of the arguments I raised to the Court of Appeals. There was nothing brought forward that was a controlling issue in the jury's deliberation. And I'd also note that Kilgore's brief indicates...
Well, if we were to write an opinion that said that the instruction should not have been given, and then have to move to the next point where we would have to evaluate whether or not the error was harmful, how would you write the opinion? What would it say in terms of saying that it was not harmful?
Your Honor, my opinion would be that the court should determine whether or not there was an abuse of discretion in the instruction that was given. And
well, if we say that there was an abuse of discretion, then we still would have to decide whether or not the giving of the instruction was harmful. And my question to you is, what argument do you make as to why it was not harmful?
The only argument that I think is reasonable is that there was no evidence, either in terms of the information from the jurors, that was a controlling issue, in terms of the nature of the case, in saying that was the only issue that controlled the outcome of the case, when there were a myriad of factors that indicated that the proper decision was made. There was substantial
evidence. Well, but that's only from your viewpoint.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Ms. Kilgore has a different viewpoint.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, what evidence would we look at to show that, in fact, this did not lead to a different result than what would have been achieved had the instruction not been given? What would we look at?
Other than the totality of the evidence, there is no specific point.
Well, I know, but give us a summary of that totality of the evidence that you're referring to that would make this not a harmful error.
In this circumstance, there was evidence, or in this case, there was evidence of abuse of drugs by Ms. Gilmore. There was evidence of a lack of care and concern, a lack of improper placement with third parties in terms of day-in, day-out care, leaving the child in circumstances with third parties for substantial periods of time. There was evidence of difficulty maintaining the work situation and violation of trust as a nurse. There was issues of criminal convictions related to drug abuse. There was difficulty in maintaining probationary terms or terms out on bond. There were a number of factors that show there are concerns about the circumstance placing the child back with the mother. And again, in a balancing scheme, I think there was very little evidence to indicate that the Hicks had any negativism or any negative issues that were brought forward in terms of their ability to care.
What about the answer to the question in the context of the legal issue that a failure to properly instruct on the law is an abuse of discretion and is reversible error when there's no mention in the charge of the Taylor versus Meeks statement that it's a factor but not controlling? Do I recall your brief said somewhere that the judge did instruct on factor? And if so, where is that in the record?
Judge, I believe the instruction given to the jury was the only instruction about the Taylor versus Meek, a factor. It is a factor.
Where can I find in the record the statement out of Taylor versus Meek?
There is no specific statement in the record as to that issue, Your Honor.
It's not included in the factors in the best interest of the child instruction that the child did.
I do not recall it specifically being factored.
But you're saying that it's not anywhere in any instruction in writing that the court gave the jury.
In my recollection, Your Honor, no, not specifically as it's set forth in Taylor versus Meek.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. John Nation will present argument to the respondents.
May it please the court, my name is John Nation. I'm from Dallas County, and I'm representing Leanne Kilgore in this case. I wanted to start
Mr.
by noting
that. Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Why can't we just look at the statute 153, 131, and say that the presumption applies in original proceeding, and this is not an original proceeding?
Sure. We can't say that because it would make very little sense to have a parental presumption and have it just apply to an original proceeding, whereas in this case, in a modification proceeding, you might have a third party coming in wanting managing conservatorship who had never litigated with the parent.
Why does that make any difference? Under 153, when we're talking about original proceedings, there are certain standards that the legislature has promulgated that must be followed in making the original determination. And you agree that 156, I take it, is the chapter that governs modification proceedings.
Sure.
And it sets out different standards for modifying an original order. So why wouldn't we then, I mean, hasn't the legislature made a determination that there are certain evidentiary requirements to be met if you are making an original decision, and then has set out a second set that is to be followed if, in fact, it's a modification proceeding?
Well, such an argument assumes that 156 and the 131 cannot be harmonized and are just separate instances or separate facets
of
the law.
But do you agree with me, though, that we have one set of procedures and standards that the legislature has promulgated in the original proceeding and a separate set that the legislature has promulgated when it comes to a modification?
Surely, and I believe that in a case such as this where you have a third party coming in who has never been in an original proceeding with the parent before, the parent should still have the parental presumption. Now, assuming...
But the parent was involved in the original proceeding, so the parent has already had the opportunity in the original proceeding to have the benefit of whatever benefit 153 may give them. And in fact, then it just puts the third party to the burden, as 156 requires, to show the modification, to meet the standards for modification. Why doesn't that statutory scheme, why shouldn't we be following the legislative intent and using that particular statutory scheme that's been set up here?
Well, I don't think that the legislative intent is necessarily all that clear. In other words, I don't think that reading 156 is going to necessarily give one the idea that the parental presumption would never be a factor or wouldn't control in a case such as we have here.
Well, but those are two different things, whether or not it's a factor or whether it's
sure, and I'll just confine my
argument. Which is it, under 156?
I say if it's a parent versus a non-parent with whom the parent has never litigated conservatorship, the parental rebuttable parental presumption applies.
So the trial court should treat this as an original proceeding under section 150, under chapter 153.
Not technically in this case because of the unique facts that we have a third party in the middle, but yes, if let's say that Ms. Kilgore had voluntarily relinquished custody to Ms. Christensen, and then, say, Ms. Christensen relinquished custody back to Ms. Kilgore, and then the Hicks come in with their motion to modify, yes, I think the judge should treat that as an original proceeding as between those two litigants. Now, if Ms. Kilgore is trying to wrest conservatorship from Ms. Christensen, no. The parental presumption is just a factor then because she's already lost conservatorship to Ms. Christensen.
Now, how do we read that? How do we get there from the statute? You're saying, yes, it would apply. It applies in this particular case, but it would not apply if Ms. Kilgore were battling with her own mother. Where do we get that from the statute? Where do we get that, yes, it applies here, but not here?
We get there from just a reading of the two statutes and attempting to harmonize them. The only case authority to give us guidance are cases which are not factually opposite here, such as Ferguson and Hodge versus Kimbrough, etc. Now, those are cases, and I think it's worth making this point. Those are cases where the parent lost conservatorship to the grandparent, third party, either through a judicial order or, as in Ferguson, you also had voluntary relinquishment. Well, then about a year later, the parent comes back and tries to get conservatorship back through a motion to modify. Well, in those situations, the courts have said, well, you as a parent, not having lost conservatorship to the grandparent, you now have to assume the burden under 156 to modify, and parental presumption itself will not get you there. Now that's different from a situation where a party such as the Hickses, who have never had conservatorship and have never wrested it away from parent, now seek custody. The proposition that they're asserting is that when Ms. Kilgore relinquished or lost conservatorship to Ms. Christensen, she lost the parental presumption forever.
Well, Mr. Nation, are you saying that when the Hicks went to court in an effort to get custody of this child, that they did not have an obligation under 156.202 of the Family Code to show that there were material and substantial changes since the entry, that they had no burden under that provision?
They had the burden of modification to
beat
Ms. Christensen.
But you just said that we have to treat this like an original proceeding because they haven't been parties. So I want to understand how, if we were to write an opinion the way you would like it to be written, how is the trial court going to manage this? Is the trial court then going to say to someone like the Hickses, who were not parties to the original order, okay, we can start all over again and we will only look at 153, and we will let 153 govern these proceedings, including the parental presumption, if you, in fact, want to get custody of the child, and they have no burden under 156.202?
I think the opinion that I would write is the approach taken by the Court of Appeals. In this case, both
Ms. Kilgore and the Hickses had identical burdens to modify because both of them were going against Ms. Christensen. Assuming both of them...
Well, then it is a 156 proceeding. It is a 156 modification proceeding.
It's a 156 up to a certain point. If, assuming both parties meet that burden of modification and are now in the ring, so to speak, themselves, then she still enjoys the parental, the rebuttable parental presumption.
But then we convert, it back to an original. We pretend it's a modification proceeding for a while, and if you show under 156.202 that the material and substantial change, then we flip it back to being like an original proceeding.
I think that's going a little further up. Yes, in essence, Your Honor.
My point is, Mr. Nation, is that the statute controls what we have to do here.
Sure.
And what you're asking, what we're now saying is that we have a 156 proceeding, and at some point in time during the course of it, we're going to convert it back to an original proceeding, and we're going to then invoke the statutory presumption at that point in time. And I'm having a hard time making that leap if, in fact, what we're supposed to be doing is doing what the legislature says is supposed to happen. And I need for you to help me make that leap.
Sure. Well, in making that leap, I would say there is no reason why the parental presumption does not apply outside of 131. There's no reason why they can't be harmonized.
Well, why then isn't it more appropriate to stay under 156 and then just say that the parental preference, as opposed to a rebuttable presumption, in fact, takes care of the parent's interest in the modification proceeding? Why isn't that enough?
Well, personally, that would be fine.
You agree there's a difference between a preference and a rebuttable presumption?
Sure, there's a difference. And if I can insert a brief commercial here, the point is this instruction doesn't even do that. The instruction, every case, Ferguson, all of them cited by petitioners say parental presumption is a factor. I'd be willing to go along with the scheme that you've outlined.
Did you request it?
There was a request by Ms. Kilgore's trial lawyer that she should get the parental presumption. But that was not given by preference.
If we look in the record at the charge, as the requested charge, are we going to find the requested instruction on the preference factor?
I'll have to go back and look at that, Your Honor, and answer by the letter.
If 153.131 does not apply, which is not entitled to presumption, then the instruction is not wrong because she wasn't entitled to it, so telling the jury she wasn't. Not error. Is that right?
No, because it's a factor. And the jury was never told
that it was a factor by the court. That's a different issue. That's a separate one. Should the jury have been instructed that it was a factor? Okay. If all 153.131 says is that she's not entitled to a presumption and references the original order and so on and so forth, if she's not entitled to presumption under 153.131, then that instruction is not error, was it?
I will concede that as long as the court understands I'm not conceding. That's right under the law.
Right, I agree. I'm just asking you to do that.
If you're going to take a pure statutory interpretation, then you're probably right. But there are fact issues involved in that because something like voluntary relinquishment, that's a fact issue. And again, I would say that the instruction even goes too far on the statutory side because what it's saying essentially is if the parent ever loses conservatorship, if there's been any order to any third party, not even before the court, there goes the parental presumption. And that's a different approach than what you've taken. So I think the instruction is faulty even on statutory grounds as well.
Well, Mr. Nation, is from your answers to the questions, it seems to me that you're staying on a plane that the matter is a presumption and it's controlling, and that should have been submitted as an instruction, as opposed to the one that was actually submitted, which was the reverse.
Well, I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that my position is the instruction was an abuse of discretion because it was legally faulty. Now, where we actually end up in terms of the parental presumption is almost a side issue. Well, I mean, it's not exactly necessary to resolution of this case.
Well, but if I understand your argument, you would have been happy in the trial court if the presumption had been submitted as a presumption under 153, and that's the way you wanted the charge. And it's not clear whether you had a fallback position. If you don't like that instruction, then under case law, my client's entitled to an instruction that it has to be, or it's at least a factor. So I guess maybe the question is, if you can't sustain the presumption and you want to talk about preference as suggested by Justice Hankinson, did you preserve a different kind of instruction as a factor or not?
I don't really believe that the trial lawyer requested an instruction on preference.
And if that's the case, what makes the instruction that was actually given harmful error under the procedural aspect of this case?
Because the jury was in effect instructed that parental preference was no factor. The instruction reads that way.
How was that harmful error to your mind?
Because she is entitled,
Mr. Fox,
I'm sorry, stepping on your questions. She's entitled to any benefit that the law gives her in terms of the way the case should be decided. And if it's a factor, it's a factor, and the jury's entitled to know that from the court. And worse than that, the instruction informs the jury that she enjoys no status, preference, whatever, by virtue of being a natural parent.
So is it your position then that if the instruction is legally correct, that it was nevertheless a comment on the evidence?
One could look at it that way.
Mr. Nash, looking at 153.131B, there is a qualification on the presumption that a finding of a history of family violence involving the parents of a child removes the presumption under this subsection. How does that affect this case?
I was looking at that last night. The that was added effective September 1st, 1997. The trial was held in November 1997. I went back and looked at the applicability provision, and the applicability provision is tied into 71.008, and it's not entirely crystal clear, but that applicability provision says, you know, they're talking about protective orders, they say, the law in effect at the time the suit was brought controls. So, admittedly not 100% clear, but my position on that would be that that later addition would not control in this case because the suit was filed before it was enacted. So, in terms of the statutory interpretation that the petitioners wish to put on this isn't really supported by case law. Case law that they do cite really deals with a different situation. I think the Court of Appeals adequately resolved the issues, and their opinion is correct, and I would urge that the Court affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
Thanks. Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court, Mr. Toby Goodman will present the rebuttal for the petitioners.
Mr. Goodman, would you please respond to Mr. Nation's argument that even if you're right about the statute, that this was still a faulty instruction?
Your Honor, I don't believe it was a faulty instruction because I believe it's a Chapter 156 suit. It's a modification.
Assume that we decide against you on that issue. Well, I mean, assume that we decide with you on that issue. he says that even if that's the case, this instruction still wasn't okay.
Because the instruction said...
Goes too far.
There's no parental preference.
It goes too far.
Well, there is no parental preference because someone else has the primary rights.
But that talking about fact, parental preference being a factor.
Judge, I couldn't hear you.
But the instruction doesn't talk about it being a factor. And the argument would be that that's the problem with the instruction. How do you respond to that?
The instruction doesn't talk about it being a factor. It just says, as I understand what the instruction was, and John tried the case, as I understood what the instruction said, it says there is no parental preference.
Why isn't that a comment on the way to the other?
I can't answer that.
So we could find for you legally that the instruction was a proper legal statement of the law, but that its giving and the way it was given was an improper comment on the way to the evidence.
I don't know that it would be an improper comment on the way to the evidence that there is no parental presumption, that the burden is under 156.101. In this particular case, someone else had the rights of a parent. This is a Chapter 156 proceeding. It's not a Chapter 153 proceeding. It's not an original proceeding.
But I understand
what
that, but in many, many cases, following up on Judge Abbott's original question, in what other instance does a trial court allow instructions on different presumptions? And, I mean, typically with broad form submission, we don't allow instructions on different presumptions and things in other contexts. And why should we in this context?
That there's not a parental preference. I don't know that I can answer that one either. I'm not doing very well up
here. Let me ask you this. Was there an objection in the trial court on that basis that this, even if you're right about the law, this is an impermissible comment on the way it is?
There was not an objection. There was also not an instruction request on parental preference. There was an instruction request on parental presumption.
Let me ask a question, Mr. Goodman. Did I hear you say that because Ms. Christensen had the managing conservatorship at the time of this hearing, that that's how come the parental preference doesn't apply? This is not a situation where custody is being sought against the parent?
That's correct. Yeah. It's... You have two different types of proceedings in the suit affecting parent-child relationships. You have the 153 proceedings, which are original proceedings, where you do have a parental preference against a third party that can be overcome with family violence if they're seeking joint. In this particular case, Judge, they couldn't seek joint because of the family violence. So you go back to a sole managing conservatorship burden under 156.101. But under 153, there's a parental preference as to a non-parent, absent family violence, and you have to prove significant impairment.
But
that's an original proceeding. In a modification case, the parent is removed. The parent is either a possessory conservator, a non-primary joint managing conservator. Someone else has the parental rights. Someone else has the right to determine where the child goes to school, where the child lives. You're seeking to modify that order as to that individual. That's why the parental preference doesn't apply.
Does it make a difference that if it so happens now that the real contest in this modification hearing is between a natural parent and a non-parent or non-parent couple?
Well, the contest...
So the actual controversy between those classes and the person who's had sole possessory conservatorship, it basically says, I relinquished that right, and here's my choice, if you want to know, but I relinquished that right. She doesn't contest the
Mr. Justice, the contest is over modifying the order.
I understand, but the parties,
you know, how the parties
give this factual circumstance. Makes it why we're here today, as a matter of fact, isn't it?
That's probably why we're here today.
Mr. Goodman, one quick question. Were you at trial?
No, sir.
Okay.
Never mind that.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
All rise.